is a nice crowd out there. It's just great to see so many people in the audience. I know that many of you, I'm sure, are just as enthusiastic as I am that the Memphis Belle is here. It's going to be taken care of properly. I can see by the number of people out here that I'm sure everyone's excited. I have a lot to cover tonight. There are many facets of the Memphis Belle, which I think will be of interest. My participation with the Memphis Belle, I'm in the research division, as many of you know. I'm a historian here. I've worked on many of the restoration projects, and the Memphis Belle is my big research responsibility right now in my job. It's going to be a multi-year project. We have a lot of work to do with the research. So I started investigating the Memphis Belle about 4 months ago, and I've continued to do the research pretty intensively. So, and when all is said and done, we'll have some question and answer after the lecture. So any questions you might have, I'll answer them as best as I can. Well, there it is, the Memphis Belle. It's an airplane that was built by Boeing. It was ordered in 1941. But it's much more than just aluminum and oil and gas. This is the crew of the Memphis Belle. And when I was thinking about what I wanted to title the lecture tonight, I had a lot of different choices. But I came down with restoring an American icon, because that's really truly what this airplane is and this crew. It's more than just an airplane. It's more than just a story. Its value, it goes beyond just simple history. It really is an icon. And I would ask that you just take a close look at these 10 men here. And I want to state their names before I go into the lecture. From left to right is Tech Sergeant Harold Locke. He was the engineer. He manned the top turret, 250 caliber machine guns. The next person over is Staff Sergeant Cecil Miller. He manned the ball turret underneath the aircraft. Next is Tech Sergeant Robert Hansen. He was the radio operator. He also, if it was put in the aircraft at the time, operated the radio gun. It was a single 50 caliber. Next is Captain James Varinas. He was the co-pilot, sat in the right seat. Then Captain Robert Morgan, the pilot. And much of the history of this aircraft revolves around Robert Morgan. And so I will talk a little bit more about him tonight. Next is Captain Vincent Effens. He was the bombardier. Then Staff Sergeant John Quinlan, tail gunner. Staff Sergeant Tony Nastall, right waist gunner. Captain Charles Layton, navigator. And finally, Staff Sergeant Bill Winchell, left waist gunner. This is the crew of the Memphis Belle. Unfortunately, none of them are with us today, but they certainly live on in the memory and in the artifact that is the aircraft. Now, the Memphis Belle is most famous as the first 8th Air Force bomber to make 25 missions over Europe and return back to the United States. In addition to this part of the aircraft and crew's fame, there were two major motion pictures that were made about the aircraft and the crew, one in 1944, one in 1990. And then, since World War II, there have been several Memphis Belles. There's the F-105D Memphis Belle II, which is in the National Museum's collection in the Southeast Asia War Gallery. There have been three B-52G Memphis Belles, and the top two images, those panels were cut out of those aircraft before they were scrapped, and those panels are also in the collection of the National Museum. There was a B-52H Memphis Belle 4. There was a C-141C Memphis Belle 5. There was a B-1B Memphis Belle, and it was with the Georgia Air National Guard, and Robert Morgan, the Memphis Belle's pilot, actually flew in this airplane. And then finally, yes, even a Hungarian helicopter that was in the Balkans. So I don't know if fame can spread much farther than around the world in 60 years later. Now, this is the Memphis Belle today as it sits in our restoration facility. Excuse me. And what I want to talk about tonight is how the aircraft got its history and got to where it is today, and also where it's going in the future. So we'll start at the beginning. The B-17, the XB-17, the prototype, first flew in 1935. The salient point about the B-17 is that the B-17 was conceived as a four-engine, long-range strategic bomber. Now, the heart, or one of the hearts of air power theory, is the concept of strategic bombardment. Not supporting troops in contact, that's tactical, it's a different concept, but going far behind enemy lines, striking the vital centers of the enemy, their war factories, their energy-producing facilities, and that sort of thing. You have to have a weapon to do it. Without the proper weapon, it's just a concept. And there was a fight over what kind of bomber the Army Air Corps was going to buy. And some suggested that we buy the B-18, which is a twin-engine bomber, much less capable but a lot cheaper. Or others had recommended that we buy the much more expensive B-17 because it was so much more capable. Well, fortunately, we did buy a small number of those, and in the end, by the beginning of World War II and by the time we entered in 1941, there was full-scale B-17 production. And this airplane and, to some degree, the B-24, which came along later, more B-24s were built, but when the concept of a four-engine long-range bomber was being tossed around, it was the B-17 that was the first to be really to be on the scene. So this is the prototype. You can see it's fairly well armed. It got the name the Flying Fortress when a reporter saw it and exclaimed it's a Flying Fortress. And so that stuck, and that became the official name. So I'm going to fast forward through the early versions of the B-17 and just talk about the transition from B-17E to B-17F. The Memphis Belle was a B-17F. There were about 200 changes going from the B-17E to the B-17F. Some of the important changes were wider propellers. The nose was configured slightly different. It was an all plexiglass enclosure, and it had the ability to mount two 50 caliber machine guns in the front of the nose, whereas the B-17E had 30 caliber machine guns. It was the fastest of the B-17s. There was a consortium of companies, in addition to Boeing, building the B-17, which included Vega and Douglas. And finally, about 3,400 B-17Fs were built in total before it went on to the later production B-17G. The main weakness of the B-17F was that it didn't have a chin turret. Later on, that would become a problem in the skies over Europe, and the B-17G, the next version, had a chin turret. This is where the Memphis Belle was born. At plant number 2 in Seattle, Washington, the Boeing plant. And the Memphis Belle was one of the first 300 B-17Fs built, so it was an early B-17F. The Memphis Belle was accepted in July of 1942, and then of all places it went to Wright Field to be modified for combat in Europe. At the time, rather than put some kinds of equipment on the line in the factories and where there were changes in these equipment, they didn't put them on at the factories. They got the airplanes out. They went from there to modification centers where military radios, military armament, and other material was added to the aircraft, prepared for combat, and then sent overseas. Wright Field happened to be one of those places, and it just so happens that like I said, the Memphis Belle came here, which is really kind of a remarkable thing considering now. The airplane went from Wright Field, it was ferried to Bangor Field in Maine, and there it was picked up by Captain Robert Morgan. Actually, he was a lieutenant at the time. It's in Maine where the airplane received its name, the Memphis Belle. So where did that name come from? Robert Morgan was from Asheville, North Carolina, so it didn't come from that. It came from this young woman, Margaret Polk. She was 19 years old. She was a descendant of President Polk, obviously from Memphis. She had a sister who was married to a doctor. Now stay with me. Her sister was married to a doctor in the 91st Bomb Group. The 91st Bomb Group was out in Washington, and her sister was going to go visit her husband, but was concerned about going across the country on her own. Her mom said, well, why don't you take Margaret along? You'll have a good time. So she went out there, and there Margaret and Robert Morgan met, and they fell madly in love, not right away, but they did. And before they went overseas, he asked her to marry him, and she did say yes. She became his fiance. And so he named the airplane after Margaret Polk. And actually, he found a way to go to Memphis with the airplane before they went overseas. That's a whole nother story, but we don't have hours tonight. He was very creative, let's just say that. So the 91st Bomb Group deployed. They ferried their airplanes over to England. And the first field that they went to, they left on the 25th of September, 1942. They landed at Kimbolton, but it's another remarkable story that I wish I had more time to talk about. But they managed to acquire Bassingbourne Field in England. Now, a lot of the bomb groups that went over, they went to these rough fields. It really wasn't very comfortable. They weren't permanent facilities. Surely the RAF wasn't going to give Americans permanent facilities and give themselves the poor ones. Well, they finagled their way into getting Bassingbourne, which is a pre-war field. It was wonderful. Permanent buildings, and so they sort of became squatters, and in the end they were able to stay at Bassingbourne. Well, they went there in October of 1942, and it's here that the airplane got the final artwork that we all recognize. This artwork was painted initially in Maine by a poor artist, and when they got to Bassingbourne, there was an artist in the group named Tony Starcher, and he was a pretty skilled artist, so he heavily touched it up and made it look much better. And on the right hand side you see Tony Starcher's artwork, and obviously you can see the original artwork that it was painted from. The artist is George Petty, and he doesn't get the kind of recognition that Vargas got, but actually Petty was doing the pinups before Vargas, and he was doing it for Esquire magazine. He had a fight with Esquire magazine, and Vargas kind of took over. So he doesn't quite get the recognition he deserves for that, but it was a George Petty pinup. And then in November, rather than obviously then go through every mission, because there's a lot of things I would like to talk about tonight, I just want to kind of talk about some of the hot missions that they had, some of the key missions that they had. The first mission was on the 7th of November, 1942, and about this time, it's important to remember that this is not 1944, early 1945, where the strategic bombing campaign's going quite well, and we have fighter escort going all the way to Berlin and back, and clearly the Allies are winning the war. At this time, we are just invading North Africa in Operation Torch. We've had limited success in the Pacific, but by no means had the Battle of Midway and some of our initial success has been recognized as a turning point. So it was a pretty dark time, and certainly there was going to be no way we could strike Germany on the ground. So the strategic bombing campaign was very important. And also, it wasn't just important to the country, it was important to the Army Air Forces, because the concept of strategic bombing was a key part of air power theory. So there was a lot riding on these early heavy bombers in Europe. The first mission, like I said, was 7th of November. It was against the sub-Pens at Brest. It wasn't a particularly hairy mission. But the next one, mission number two, 2 days later, was. They tried to come in at low altitude. It was at Saint-Nazaire in France. And they came in at low altitude. They're trying some different things. It wasn't a good idea. The Memphis Belle got 62 holes in it from anti-aircraft fire. And several aircraft were shot down. Now, mind you, each B-17 carried 10 crewmen typically, so the loss of 3 aircraft in a group meant 30 people didn't come back. The next mission, again, was a hairy mission, was again to Saint-Nazaire. It was on the 17th of November, and in this case, the Memphis Belle got hit during a fighter attack and had a large hole blown in the left wing. Now, there are a lot of sort of stories that run about the Memphis Belle, and one that you might hear is that they never got damaged. That's just simply not true. They got damaged several times. You can still see some of the damage in the artifact now that was not repaired at the time. There was no need to. And they weren't going on milk runs, as they're called, these easy missions. They got damaged several times, and in fact, three times the aircraft received major damage. So I would like to take just a minute to talk about some of the dangers that the Memphis Belle crew, along with all the other crews in the B-17s and the B-24s, the dangers that they faced. Because I feel, and many other people feel, that the Memphis Belle has become an icon and represents all the heavy bomber crews in Europe. And so the Memphis Belle story in many ways is akin to the story of all these crews in the 8th Air Force in World War II. Well, losses. The losses were tremendous, especially at this stage. Of the aircraft that the 91st Bomb Group got during the war, they lost nearly half of them in combat or in accidents. Nearly half. And that's over the course of 3 years. They lost nearly 200 bombers. It's a staggering number. Like I said, when you consider there are 10 men in each aircraft. During the time that the Memphis Belle was in combat, it's about 8 months, the 91st Bomb Group lost 30 aircraft. They didn't come over with 30 aircraft. So in essence, they lost their entire strength in that 8 months. Of course, they were getting reinforcements periodically, so that's why they still were able to fly. But in those 3 years, the 91st Bomb Group had 1,150 personnel, air crews, become POWs, and over 600 were killed. I couldn't find any numbers on wounded. I'm waiting for the official records to come up from Maxwell. I'm going to get copies of the group. But the numbers of wounded had to be in the thousands. That's one group. So needless to say, it was a dangerous time. There are a number of ways that a crewman could be lost or wounded. One was with Luftwaffe fighter attacks, a German air force. Like I said, there was not fighter cover on some of the missions all the way to the target and back. And even if there could be, just because of the short range of the fighters at the time, even if there was fighter cover that was scheduled, it wasn't unusual for there to be a mix-up in the rendezvous, and that didn't cancel the mission. They continued on. So sometimes they were to be provided fighter cover, but there was a mix-up. The fighter cover never showed up, so they continued on to the target alone. Another thing, too, is that just because an airplane was lost doesn't mean that all the crewmen were safe. It wasn't unusual for an aircraft to be heavily damaged and to come back with wounded or dead crewmen. And unfortunately for the guys on the aircraft, if they were on a long mission and they got wounded, they wouldn't receive professional medical care for hours. So, and this is a picture of an aircraft with an engine knocked out. Then, of course, there was the danger that when they did get back to base, if there was combat damage, if the flaps were damaged, if other control surfaces were damaged, it made landing pretty risky, and there were occasions when there were wounded crewmen on board who couldn't parachute out. So if the pilot bailed out, then they would surely die. So many crash landings. Here's just a few examples of some of the damage that were on some of the aircraft that came back, and I'm sure many of you have seen several of these types of photos, but you know, in the photo on the right, the tail gunner surely didn't survive. And then the hole in the aircraft on the left is right where the engineer would be standing if he was manning the turret gun. So just because an airplane came back didn't mean that all the crewmen were going to survive. And then also there's what may seem to be superficial damage to the aircraft, like in this case, flak damage. But the skin on these aircraft is very thin. And there was some armor in the aircraft, but it was limited because the armor was heavy, and it means that shorter range, fewer bombs could be carried. So it was a balancing act. Well, this damage on the outside that seems somewhat superficial, that's what it looks like on the inside. And you can imagine what that could have done to the waist gunners. That's the area of the aircraft where that damage is. So the Memphis Belle got through their initial missions, and they had some missions that weren't too bad. But like I said, on many of the missions, they did get damaged. I'd just like to mention just a few of them. There was a mission to Lorient where an FW-190, a German fighter, was coming in a head-on attack. like I'd mentioned before, the B-17F was a little weak on the nose guns compared to the later B-17G, so it was a favored tactic of the Luftwaffe to attack formations from the front. And in this case, Robert Morgan saw it coming, and he really was a hotshot pilot. He really was something else. He flew that airplane sometimes like it was a fighter. It's amazing the wings didn't fall off of that airplane. But he saw it coming in. He pulled the nose up, and so it threw off the aim of the German pilot. So instead of getting hit in the nose, they got hit in the tail, and the tail caught fire. And they lost contact with the tail gunner, and Morgan was yelling, you know, "Quinlan, Quinlan, are you there? Are you there?" And Quinlan was fighting the fire, and in the end, he put the fire out, and he was okay. On another mission to Rouen in France, the tail position was hit again, but this time Quinlan got wounded, and he did receive the Purple Heart. That's another misnomer that, you know, been bandied about, that no one was wounded on that airplane. It's not true. Quinlan was wounded. Two other crewmen were wounded, but they never reported their injuries, so they never received Purple Hearts for them. Finally, there was a mission to Saint-Nazaire. Saint-Nazaire was not a good target for the Memphis Belle or their crew. There was one engine that was knocked out, and another one was leaking oil, but they did manage to limp back home. So I've left out some of the missions into Germany. They did fly missions into Germany. All their missions weren't just in France, but at the time, the strategic bombing campaign, a lot of the targets that were being hit were in France. It doesn't mean that they were any less vigorously defended by the Luftwaffe. They were going after airfields, submarine pens, particularly to try and lessen the threat from the U-boats in the Atlantic. But there were several missions that the Memphis Belle crew did fly to Germany. And in those missions, the escort left before they reached the German border, and they continued into German territory unescorted. Well, the Memphis Belle crew, they flew their last mission on 17 May of 1943. It was to Lorient, France. And like I said before, Morgan was a heck of a pilot. He came in and beat the heck out of that airfield. And it was pretty typical for the pilots to do that when they got to their 25 missions. But in this case, Morgan, this is not the airplane, by the way, but this is one of the pilots buzzing the field. He came right at the control tower, and they thought for sure that he was going to hit the control tower, and he didn't. So he was really kind of a vigorous pilot, to say the least. I didn't mention the importance of 25 missions. Why is 25 missions important? Well, that was the number that the authorities came up with, that if a crewman got 25 missions, they could go home. And 25 missions may not sound like as much compared to maybe some later conflicts and later wars, but 25 missions, the odds were not really great that a person was going to get through 25 missions without getting wounded, become a POW, or be injured. Part of the reason that they came up with a 25 mission quota was for morale, because it was so dangerous that if these air crews thought, well, they're just going to stick me into here, I'm never going to make it out of here. You know, and so the 25 mission mark was a good idea. And then these crews could come back and help train fledgling air crews before they went to combat. That number was later raised in the war as the odds became better that a crewman was going to survive. And here they are. We've got our 25 missions. We're going home. And then there's the airplane in the background. And, of course, there's the obligatory painting of the last bomb on the side of the airplane. It has 25 bombs. Each one, of course, represents a mission. And I do think it's important to mention the guy who's painting the bombs on there, Master Sergeant Joseph G.M. Brown. He became a Master Sergeant. He was not a career maintenance man. So to become a Master Sergeant is pretty impressive, considering that he enlisted in the wartime. And nothing but high praise for what he did. There were several times the Memphis Belle came back beat up. He and his crew would stay up all night, get the airplane ready. He changed 9 engines. Nothing but positive words about this guy here. So easy to forget that the air crews are flying the airplane, but the people who are keeping it in the air are the guys on the ground. working night and day. And before they left, Robert Morgan saying goodbye to the ground crew. He had wanted them to come back, but they were too important. And in the case of the crew chief, he stayed in England till the end of the war. So at the end of their 25 missions, they were all awarded Distinguished Flying Crosses. There was a ceremony with General Devers. He was the commander of the European Theater of Operations. There was General Aker, who was commander of the 8th Air Force. They were also at a ceremony where the King and Queen of England came out to see them, look at the airplane. And later in his life, Robert Morgan met with the Queen again about 5 years ago or so, and they reminisced about that time so long ago. There was one other aircraft that made 25 missions called Hell's Angels. It's not a controversial thing. It's accepted by the crews, in fact, that flew the Memphis Belle. But the Memphis Belle was the first to get 25 missions and come back home, and that's very important. Because they called it their 26th mission. Now, crews that were going over or getting ready to go over, they weren't dumb. They knew what was going on. They knew what the odds were. So, you know, there were questions about, not that they would fly and fight. Obviously, they would. But it's terrible for their morale. And also, the public needed to know what's going on. The public needed to know that we were having success in the bombing campaign in Europe. Because a lot of the news from the front really wasn't that great. So their 26th mission was a war bond tour. And this pamphlet that you see on the left, it was restricted when it was issued. But it stated that there were these three reasons for the war bond tour. There's a fourth reason, but this pamphlet was largely directed toward the, obviously since it was restricted, toward military personnel. The fourth mission for the war bond tour was to raise war bonds and raise public morale, particularly in war factories. I did my master's thesis on bomber production at Willow Run, and there were at times huge problems with motivating the workforce for numbers of reasons. But having actual people come back and say, hey, listen, we depend on you. We need you. You know, our guys are dying, and we need you to do your job well and to do it effectively and get these aircraft out to us. But in the pamphlet, it talked about the encouraging the confidence and the fighting spirit of the combat crews. Those are for the ones just getting ready to go. They wanted to let them know, hey, you can do this. You know, we're doing a good job over there. You know, go get them. And then also, second thing would be to pass on their experience to these fledgling air crews that are learning how to fly, learning gunnery, learning navigation. And then finally, to kind of spread the word to the public on the great achievements that were going on in the 8th Air Force, to let them know it was tough, but we're doing the job. There were several stops on the war bond tour. The first one was to National Airport, to Reagan, for two P-47s. And these two hotshot P-47 pilots were hot-dogging all over the sky. And it just bothered the heck out of Morgan because it was their show. So why are these guys taking away the show? So he thought, fine, I'll do crazy maneuvers across the sky. What are they going to do, court-martial me? This is for us. So that's exactly what they did. He just tore that B-17 around, buzzed the field, came in and landed, and there was some high-ranking officers there, but he wasn't punished. So it's kind of a typical style for him. But that was in June of 1943. And over the next 3 months, they stopped at 33 locations all across the country. Army, Air Force, Air Force's bases, war factories, major cities. Their second stop was to Memphis, Tennessee. But another one of their stops, here we have this circle going around again, was at Patterson Field. Wright Field and Patterson Field were important centers for the Army Air Forces, a lot of development work going on here in addition to modification work. So here Robert Morgan is up on a podium, and this was a typical backdrop for the war bond tour with the American flag and the Memphis Belle right behind. And here are some of the quotes, some of the things that he talked about and the crew talked about some of the wisdom that they were trying to pass on to the public and to war workers and to future aviators in combat. And he even got promoted to major here at Patterson Field, and here he is getting his leaves. There was one additional member of the crew, and her name was Stuka. And she was a dog that had been given to Varinus, the co-pilot. And he took her with him all the way around on the bond tour. And in fact, they even had on the emergency crew door underneath her name on that door. And the door is on display next to the aircraft over in restoration. So the next time you're over there, do keep an eye out for it. Well, I've deliberately left out a pretty big chunk of the Memphis Belle story up till now because I wanted to kind of talk about the combat in an unbroken way. There's a movie called The Memphis Belle, and it was produced by a gentleman by the name of William Wyler. He was a famous director, continued to be a famous director beyond the war. He had been commissioned. He was part of the Army Air Forces, so he's Major William Wyler. And what he did was really remarkable. He had he, along with several of his people, took cameras aboard these aircraft in combat. So what y'all were seeing before the lecture started tonight was part of that film. And the shots that you see in combat, that's real. And in fact, more than one of the cameramen got killed getting this footage. So really remarkable, and it's color on top of it. So I highly encourage each one of you, you can purchase it, you can go to your local library, you can if your local library doesn't have it, you can get it through interlibrary loan. I highly recommend that if you haven't seen this, please do. Some of the material is not entirely true. A lot of it has to do with wartime and censoring. For instance, the last mission in the film is Wilhelmshaven, and it wasn't. But if you notice when you see the film, a lot of the details about the unit are not talked about. You know, so there were wartime issues that really couldn't be talked about in the film. But the footage in combat is real, and people died to get it. So it's a really remarkable thing, and of course that's William Wyler right there. The film premiered in April of 1944, so this is less than a year after the War Bond Tour, and it premiered in Memphis, Tennessee, naturally. And initially the film almost didn't get produced. It almost got quashed because it was initially viewed by some Navy officers, and it really promoted the concept of strategic bombing. But there was a second screening, and President Roosevelt saw it, and he said every American should see this. So certainly it was produced. And I agree with him. I think it's something every American should see. A note about another group that helped with the film, Paramount. Paramount marketed and distributed the film with no profit. So they cooperated with the War Department. So tip of the hat to them for doing that. After the War Bond Tour, each crewman was given the opportunity to do pretty much what they wanted to do in the military. A few stayed back in the States to do training and train new air crews. And Morgan said, "Nope, I want another airplane. I want to go back." So he went into B-29 training. And in the meantime, things didn't work out with his Memphis sweetheart. And so he ended up marrying Dorothy in December 1943. So his B-29 was Dauntless Dottie. But an amazing thing is that when he went to the Pacific, he was the aircraft commander, the pilot, on the lead B-29 on the first B-29 raid against Tokyo, which is pretty amazing in and of itself. So that's another part of the remarkable legacy of the Memphis Belle. He did try to get a few others of his crewmen from the Memphis Belle onto his airplane, He ran into the notorious red tape, but he did get Vince Evans, his bombardier on the Memphis Belle, to be on his aircraft, and he ended up flying about 30 missions in B-29s during the war. Meanwhile, the Memphis Belle. Memphis Belle went on to be a training aircraft. There were actually many people that flew the Memphis Belle, but most of them, they did it in training in Florida. And then at the end of the war, the aircraft went to Altus, Oklahoma, along with many aircraft from the Army Air Forces. In 1946, the city of Memphis got a crew together, and they got the airplane in running shape, and the aircraft was flown to Memphis. And that's the crew getting ready to fly it out there. It sat in a hangar for about 5 years until finally it was put on display on a pedestal. There were periods in that 5 years where it was sitting outside, but from 1950 to 1977, it sat in front of the National Guard Army in Memphis on this concrete pad, exposed to the weather and exposed to vandals. And over the course of this time, the aircraft deteriorated and it was stripped. It was stripped pretty badly. There was some barbed wire that was put on top of the fence, but that wasn't going to stop people. There's another picture of the aircraft. So, by 1979, this is what the aircraft looked like. Seriously deteriorated, but what was left on there at this time, except for the nose piece, was original. So, although corroded, although it had some problems, you know, that's original paint, that green that you see on the left-hand side there. The rest is natural metal. There's a little bit of green, but mostly natural metal. The lines are intact, largely. Here's some more photos of the aircraft. This is the nose compartment. The nose piece there, that's not original, but you can see natural metal. This is the bombardier station, stripped. You can see the corrosion. But again, what paint is on there is original paint. Here's what's left of the instrument panel. Just the panel. The co-pilot's position, the wheel had been stolen. But again, the paint that's on there is original paint. So there's primary evidence it's still on the aircraft. And lastly, here's the radio compartment. And you can see it's the airplane had really fallen down. And this is 1979, so this is 27 years ago. The aircraft was moved to Mud Island in Memphis in 1987, and some attempts at restoration were made. The Mud Island site was at times in serious jeopardy of being flooded. The structure that was put over the Belle was open to the elements on the side. There were problems with birds coming in, and their droppings would be on the aircraft, which is bird droppings are highly caustic, and they have to be constantly cleaned off for the damage of the aircraft. So it better than it was outside, but certainly not ideal. A few years after the move, the next movie. This one is much more Hollywood and much less accurate than the first Memphis Belle movie, but it was produced by the daughter of William Wyler. And I think the important thing about this film is it's an entertainment film. It's a Hollywood film, but it keeps the name alive. It means that people who otherwise might not have any idea of the Memphis Belle would at least see this movie. Some of the combat scenes are fairly good, but there's a lot of the relationships don't really hold the form. The crew, there's some real bickering in the crew in the movie. All the crew members said that in actuality it was all business, and that they got along well. They were an effective combat team. So still, it added to the fame of the Memphis Belle and helped keep the name alive. So, October 2005, the airplane came here. Basically, in a nutshell, the Air Force had owned the aircraft for some decades, and the folks down in Memphis who had the airplane were trying to restore it, and the Air Force, since it was part of the National Collection, the Air Force had standards, and there were opportunities that were given to meet those standards as far as having a proper facility for display, as far as restoring the aircraft to a professional museum standard. There were dates that were set and weren't met. So after several chances, and many of the party in Memphis who wanted what was best for the aircraft agreed it needed to come back here to be properly cared for. So we're back to today. So now the future. What's going to be next for this incredibly important artifact? Well, it's going to be in restoration for 8 to 10 years. Now, one might say, well, looks okay in the photo. Photos look okay. Probably eight years seems like kind of a long time. Well, I'm going to take you through step by step some of the things that the research team and the restoration team are going to have to deal with. But before I go through that, I want to make one important point. Poor research leads to poor restoration. Primary sources are over and above the best sources for the restoration of an artifact. That would include original photographs, credible and reliable statements from people who were there. It includes documents, original documents, technical orders, blueprints, and all those things we're looking at in the research of this aircraft. We're in contact with the Boeing archives. We've already started receiving copies of original specifications. When this is done, when this project is done, well, actually before it's done, we're going to know exactly how that airplane was when it left Boeing. Every part that was on it, we're going to know that. We're going to know how it's painted or whether it was painted. We're going to reassemble as best as we can how it was modified here at Wright Field. We've already got two documents that are coming. I'm not sure what's in them, but one is a technical document called B-17F Nose Guns. There were many variations. So we're gonna know, and we're gonna be able to show from primary sources about how that airplane was. And that's important. Picking up a book off the shelf is not primary research. This is the airplane now. It's got corrosion issues that have to be dealt with. This is the inside of one of the engine nacelles. You can see that that white chalky residue is aluminum that's deteriorating. The fasteners are rusting, so there are corrosion issues that have to be dealt with. What some might do in restoration, or they call it a restoration, is just paint over that corrosion, because it hides the corrosion and it looks fine for a while. But 5, 6, 10 years later, the corrosion is continuing. The damage is continuing to be done to the object. So that corrosion has to be dealt with. This is a picture of the bomb bay. It's the fore part of the bomb bay. You can see there's a rubber hose there that's been cut. There's insulation which has failed. That's what the sort of brown material is. This is the side of the fuselage at the wing attachment point on the left-hand side. There are lines that were cut when the wing was taken off at some point. Some of the lines were crushed. Rather, they weren't fitted up properly and they were crushed. And also, that particular part of the airplane is supposed to be natural metal. So when it was painted, it was just sprayed over. I think the pictures from 1979 really illustrate the importance of doing primary research before the airplane is painted. On the left-hand side there, you see that's a 1979. Now, albeit it's in rough shape, but you can see all the natural metal. It should stay natural metal. It's in the production specifications. It's on the object. This is how the airplane looks today. It had been sprayed over with olive drab, and the lines that are behind there that you see, those have overspray on them. They should be natural metal. Here's the bombardier station in 1979, and then you see it today. And it's not a lot different, except now it's covered in green paint. So not only are there restoration issues that have to be dealt with, as far as the corrosion and trying to get the aircraft back to being original, but there are things that have to be undone first. This is kind of a scary thing. The whole aft fuselage, except for a few of the formers, was natural metal, and today it's covered in green paint. Here's the pilot's compartment. Now this is kind of frustrating because with working with restoration, one of the things I look for and I really value is original paint, because it is what it is. Sometimes the paint has deteriorated or there's a color shift, but it can be sanded. There's a way to find out, there are several ways to find out what the actual color is of the original paint. In this case, the bright green paint is original paint, and then the sort of olive drab paint was sprayed on at some point in the last 25 years or so. So original paint has been oversprayed. So in cases where there was original paint, it was oversprayed. Here's the inside of the nose compartment. That should be all natural metal. It's two different shades of green. And then you see the electrical cable there, and that should be unpainted. It's cloth-covered cable, and some of the folks here have found a source for that electrical cable to replace it with, the cloth-covered cable. While I'm mentioning that, it's not just restoration and researchers. Other people on our staff, collections, will be looking to see what instruments we have. There'll be other people who are trying to find outside sources, original material if possible, if not something which is just like the original material. So there's a lot of investigative work that has to be done by a number of the members of the staff to try and get the airplane right. We have the resources to do that. We have the people. We have the expertise. I can think of very few organizations that would be able to do that. But needless to say, you can see the paint that's on the electrical lines. Here's another example of the overspray on the wing. I'm really pleased to say, and also you can see that there are some lines that are cut. I'm really pleased to say that the inside of the wing is largely untouched, and it's wonderful. It is just wonderful because in our collection here, we have several original manuals for the B-17F. We have flight manual, we have erection and maintenance manual, we have overhaul manual, we have engine manuals. It's really wonderful. And in the overhaul manual, it talks about how the wing, the inside of the wing, is to be dealt with in an overhaul. And it says nothing is supposed to be painted on the inside of the wing. Don't paint it, except for where the fuel tanks are. And in that case, paint it with zinc chromate. And it was the zinc chromate was usually used as a metal preservative, but in this case, it was it had a characteristic that would limit the likelihood of sparks. And obviously, around fuel tanks, sparks are not a good thing. So I had read that, and I went to look at the airplane, and lo and behold, it was untouched. And how was it done? It was unpainted, except for where the fuel tanks were. There's zinc chromate, and there's a few pieces of structure that are painted with zinc chromate. I went back and checked the overhaul manual, and it confirms that that's the way that it was done. So so that is really great that the inside of the wings are at this point untouched. There's another example of, with a museum quality restoration, it is important to note what's original and what's not original. Because with the kind of staff that we have here, they'll do it so good that 50 years from now, when we're all gone, somebody going back, they may not be able to tell what's original and what's not, because they'll do it to the standards of the time. So it is good to mark a part in an inconspicuous place or make sure it's in the paperwork. In this case, the people who worked on the catwalk and repaired it made sure that everybody knew that they did it and when they did it. That was not on the Memphis Belle in 1943. So that kind of a personal recognition just doesn't belong on a museum quality restoration. Here's an example too of the engines. Those are going to be restored, but this is one of the engines that came in, and the engine on the right is painted properly. That's original paint. It's fantastic. It's a primary resource. It's the way that it's painted is confirmed in the overhaul manuals that we have for the R1820 engine. We also contacted Wright State, where the Wright engine archive is located. There are 24,000 drawings in that collection and thousands of feet of microfilm. And so that paint that's on the original engine is confirmed. So that's how those engines are going to be marked. Well, you can see on the other engine, the front of the nose of the crankcase is painted completely wrong. It's way too light. It's blue. The bottom part of the cylinders shouldn't be painted. Or it's one or the other. They should be all black or all aluminum. It's one or the other. They didn't do both. One was baked on enamel. The other was sprayed on aluminum paint. And either would be acceptable for the time, but it wouldn't be both. So there's poor research that was done for that marking of that engine. Now, some of this may seem to be picking nits, but it's right or it's not right. And this is a national treasure. So we're all going to be gone someday. And 100 years from now, some of the best evidence for that airplane may very well be on the airplane, may be part of the artifact. So it's important that we do it right. And we have the ability to do it right because the resources are out there. The manuals are out there. The photos are out there. The technical orders are out there. The company blueprints are out there. So it's the primary resources are out there to do it the way that it was. Lastly, just a couple of things that we really won't be dealing with for a long time. These are some of the final markings on the aircraft, but this is an example of, on the left-hand side, you see what the artwork looked like, albeit in black and white, but what the artwork looked like on the aircraft. And on the right-hand side is the artwork that was done the way that it is on the aircraft now. And if you look at the perspective, particularly with the legs, with the length of one of the arms, it's really not accurate. And I'm delighted to say that the guys in restoration, I questioned them on nose art one time, and I had nothing to worry about, and they just said, just wait, just see how we do it. And that's the artwork that's on our Tornado. And I was concerned about it because I think it's restoration. This is art. They're great at doing so many other things, but this is art, not sure. So I kept my mouth shut. And it is spot on. I do encourage you, if you're in the Cold War gallery, to go and take a look at it sometime. That is what it looked like on that airplane when it was flying. I was really impressed. They got the dimensions right on. They have a technique that they use to get the outline. They take an original photograph. They put it on a transparency. They projected it onto the airplane, checked the dimensions of that using reference points like rivets or panel lines. And then they get the allies. It's amazing. So I know that is going to be accurate. And also, the person who painted on there, it was Starcer's nephew, put his name on the artwork. That wasn't on the airplane. So if it wasn't on the airplane at the time, it shouldn't be on there. It's important that he did it because there's a relative there, but not on the airplane. In the records, it should look like it did when it was flying. And lastly, and this may really seem like picking nits, but this is the level of detail that we go to. On the bottom there is a picture of the data block on the aircraft, and up above is the picture of the data block as it is now. And a couple of things to point out that where it says service this airplane with 100 octane fuel only, on the actual aircraft, the line of stars goes to the bottom of it, but in the way that it is now, it goes through it. And if you look at some of the fonts, like where it says 1,200 pounds, the 2 that's in the 1,200 pounds on the actual aircraft is different from the way that it was. It's a different font. And that data block, I'm still waiting on information from the Boeing drawings coming out. That's either that's either silk screened on there or it's a decal. It's not hand painted. And also, if you look at the serial number on the actual aircraft, that serial number is stenciled on there. And that was not an unusual technique. What Boeing did is they had the basic data block. They had it's either silk screen, like I said, or a decal. They put those on every single one. And when that fuselage got a number, a radio call number, it was stenciled on there. Totally different technique of applying the paint. And you can see it. You can see the cuts. The photo is not the best photo, but there are stencil cuts in the radio call number. So it should be like that. So that's an example of, again, like I said, it's kind of getting to a pretty fine point, but it's right or it's not right. So, and before I go to the questions, I just wanted to mention that there will be a publication that will come out of this restoration after the restoration is complete. We want to document what's going on and get it published so then the public can see what the staff did here and how the airplane was brought to a condition that it really deserves to be in. And lastly, please stay posted. So we're going to do our best over time to show progress on the aircraft. The aircraft has already been started to be worked on, and we're going to be expedient, but we're not going to be irresponsible. So it is going to take time. And thank you for your attention. So I'd be happy to entertain any questions. Okay, down in the front here. As it stands now, about the 23rd mission is what we're looking to do. The equipment is going to stay the same. The equipment is going to stay the same. It's going to be a question of the markings. And that is important to pick a point in time, because an airplane could have several different markings. And if there isn't a point in time, one could take all the markings and have a conglomeration when the airplane never had all those on at the same time. So as it stands now, though, about the 23rd mission is what we're looking at. Oh, okay, we have a mic, so I'll wait till the mic comes around. Question was, at what point is the airplane going to be restored to? Like I said, the equipment's going to stay the same, but it's going to be a question of the markings. Yes, sir. I've heard that, but I haven't confirmed it. The question is, there are reports that he looped the B-17 in Memphis. The thing is, one part of me says, no way, the airplane wouldn't take it. Another part of me, with what I read about Morgan, his crew said that he could do things with the B-17 that were just remarkable. So that's just was his personality. That said, there are a number of things which I want to confirm with primary sources about the aircraft, about the history of the aircraft. I'm not at that point yet because I'm gathering in primary resources and it's going to take time. So I try to confirm whatever the point may be as best I can. So.